prayer, the month of July is a good time. So let's see. I've been giving a good amount of thought to what I would be sharing with you this morning. And most of you know that the work I do as a hospital chaplain, and it seems that most of my talk and study have to do with life and death. I guess you could say I'm passionate about life and death. I love to hear a clear, interesting, enlightening explanation and experiences of death. Now that's in part because I then feel better prepared to meet with the patients and families as they come to grips with sickness and death, and partly because it provides me something to rely on. But I don't want to speak only of sickness and death. I want to focus today on the part, on the life part of life and death are the great matter. I want to focus on this for your sake as well as my own. Now, when I think about giving a talk, I often hark back to one I heard Reb Anderson give at Green Gulch many years ago. Now, Reb's well known for his long, intricate, intellectual talks. But the image I hold is one where he's sitting in the Wheelwright Center and he's talking about drinking a cup of tea. He talked about why tea ceremony and in Zen practice, we're encouraged to hold our bowls with two hands. So he reached for an imaginary teacup with his right hand, lifted it, placed it in his left hand, and with both hands raised the cup to his lips. It's such an all-encompassing gesture. It was such an all-encompassing gesture that I'm moved by it to this day. Putting complete attention, our right hand and our left hand, a closed circle of focus, directing the tea to our lips and then down through our body. This is something we also do with our orioki. We pick up our bowls, we hold them in two hands. It's not simply to keep them from spilling. I mean, that's a good reason. But it's also picking up, holding, containing. So when we're finished sipping, we place with two hands the cup or the bowl on the floor. And it may be then we have a conversation with someone in the room, we look to the person we're with, we take in their voice, their gestures, we listen, we respond, we take up our tea, we drink, we put it down. I recently attended the wedding of my nephew David. David's 30 and very proud of the fact that he put off marriage to his girlfriend Lindsay for the past 5 years. He did not want to be rushed. He wanted to be ready for his commitment. Lindsay had her ideas of when she wanted to marry. His mother had her ideas. His grandmothers had their ideas. But David wanted the decision and the commitment to be his, and he succeeded. He was present at his wedding. My job was to get my parents, David's grandparents, to the wedding. My dad, as some of you know, is 97. My mom's 85. Their bodies aren't very flexible. They have to be folded into the car and unfolded from the car. When they're unfolded, they need to be warmed up and watched vigilantly as the sidewalks and curbs have a way of shifting under their feet. I'm sharing this with you in my attempt to understand life. My only task on the day of the wedding was to fold and unfold my parents in such a way that brought them safely to the wedding, back to the hotel, and home the next day. While attempting to attend to my father with the care of holding a cup of tea with two hands, I was acutely aware of his physical discomfort. I had suggested he take pain medicine to ease his muscle pain prior to the journey, but he chose not to. So I helped him in and out of vehicles while he exhibited pain and strain. My mother isn't so much bothered by physical pain, but she carries a lot of ideas about the way things can be or might be or used to be. It's hard for me to hold her with two hands, completely listening in the midst of her ruminations. I wanted to attend to them completely, but it just seemed too much. There was no serenity in the action. There was no completion. There was no time that one or the other couldn't use some assistance in facilitating their movements through this new terrain called attending a wedding. So eventually I called on other family members, drifted to the dance floor, gave up my role. The next morning, my dad slid off the hotel bed and landed on the floor, banging his shoulder. He is dismayed by his failing body, angered, embarrassed, a victim of gravity and slick sheets. We got them folded back into the car, into their home, and 24 hours after we began, the wedding weekend came to an end. So something was lived. David did marry in time to have his grandparents attend his wedding. My dad of 97 did dance with his bride of 65 years. My mother looked lovely in her dress, and my dad's shoulder wasn't broken. All those things and more comprised the wedding day. But why did I feel I failed in my job? Because I couldn't prevent them from feeling pain. I couldn't prevent them from experiencing annoyance or discomfort. I couldn't prevent my dad from falling onto the floor. To do things with complete attention includes the reality that things are beyond our control. Kanzen Ingen had said, the original mind is great and round. Why do we fall into delusion and darkness? Now, this is one of the questions that sent Dogen to China and into the practice of Zen itself. We can know the original mind in the simplicity of sipping tea and in sitting zazen. We can also know the darkness of delusion when we are separated from the activity we are involved in. How can we catch ourselves before adding a thought, a second thought, a third thought to the action at hand? The Dharma encourages us, when thoughts arise, do not add any associative thought to them. If you are angry, just leave it at that. If you're happy, just leave it at that. If you're sad, just leave it at that. It's very hard for me to actively live in that place. I get a taste of it in Zazen. Thoughts are thoughts and impulses are impulses. It's just me on the cushion and the simplicity serves me well. But when I engage in relationship, this skill set often fails me. When I speak to my husband and he responds in such a way that shows he isn't adding an associative thought, I tend to think he doesn't care. I rarely appreciate what he is doing for me when he refuses to get hooked. He asked me at the wedding, "Why are you allowing yourself to get upset?" I do have a choice, but I'm not so practiced in exercising it. What would it feel like to not feel for or anticipate my parents' discomfort? What would it look like to attend but not engage? Harada Roshi says, getting rid of our thoughts is not about forcing ourselves not to think. We should not waste our efforts worrying, I shouldn't think this and I mustn't think that. It just means when you are angry, he says, cut it away. When you are happy, cut it away. When you are sad, cut it away again and again. He says, if you can live so that you are not stopped by any of your thoughts or start adding further associations to them, it will be of more value than even 10 years of pilgrimage. Every day of living will be free from attachment and obstruction. He says, if we can live in the practice of this freedom, it will have more value than 10 years of zazen in the zendo. The deepest and most profound teaching of Zen is here, he says. The way of life that holds on to nothing at all. So the way of life that holds on to nothing at all. The cup that brings tea to our lips and is returned to its place is a good start. The aged parent that is doing his best to navigate a changing world, picks himself up from the floor and carries on, deserves credit. The cancer patient who can't tell whether she is living or dying, but puts on her makeup and laughs with her caregivers, true effort. The daughter or son who want to tend to their parent, but the task is beyond them. So be it. Our work of this life is to be totally engaged, the right hand and the left hand, and holding on to nothing. Not the good, not the bad, not the pleasant, not the unpleasant. Why would anyone want to hold on to an unpleasant thought, much less add to it? I think it's because it's hard to imagine what would fill the space once let go. Maybe nothing. What would that look like? To live a life that holds on to nothing at all. So that is the that's the place. That's the place of my practice, the place I find myself in. Risking giving up that which is familiar, the ruminating, the considering, the reflecting, the anticipating, all of that is familiar to me. It's familiar and it's very old and very old pattern. I'm sharing now in just the active, the effort it takes to try something else, to try tending but not getting attached to that tending, to being with but not considering how deeply that being with is affecting or not affecting. As I've been thinking about this, I'm thinking, okay, there's some ways, as I mentioned earlier, that are fairly simple and straightforward. It takes attention to pick up the tea, to drink. For some people, that's difficult. It's difficult to bring two hands together, to focus only on the tea. I find that quite lovely, but I know at breakfast time I'm not doing that. When we eat in Orioki, we get a taste of that. We're just eating. We're tasting. We're hearing the birds. We're putting the bowl down. But do I do that at home? Sometimes, if the newspaper doesn't come in, or the New Yorker isn't calling for me, or it's even if I clear the table and put down my breakfast, there's something that's calling, that's diverting me from just eating breakfast. And I know the loveliness of just eating breakfast. So what is it? Habit? I think it's habit. So that, the simplicity of tea and bowls and what we do with ourselves. Then there's the moving amongst people that we don't have such a strong relationship with. We certainly care about all we come in contact with, but not like the relationship we would have with parents and siblings, old, ancient, twisted, lovely, karmic relationships. So to practice this with each person we come in contact with is even a little easier than with our ancient, twisted, loving, challenging, deeper relationships. So we do that. We do that in the workplace. We do that here. We do that in the market. And we do it as best we can, and we bring attention to it, and we catch ourselves when we're not meeting and we're not clear and we're adding thoughts. And then there's being with family, loved ones, people we have patterned history with. How do we bring this fairly new way of being, this new way of being for us, and it's new regardless of how long we've been aware that it's a helpful way of being. How do we bring into practice a way of being with our parents, our partners, our children, those with which we are most often in contact, and oftentimes, most often, in patterned relationship? How do we bring a freshness? How do we drop not only discursive thought, but the second thought and the third thought and the reflection on the past and the contemplation of the future? It's hard for me to imagine me doing that, though I know when it's been implemented, it's appreciated. So so that's really what I have to share today. The bringing our practice, the living of our practice, the tasting of our practice here in the Zendo, we'll sit sesshin and get a little damper, a little fuller, a little more concentrated taste of the practice. We will bring it to our workplace. We will bring it to our parents. We will bring it to our partners. We will share the practice with each other. And with the awareness that each act is a complete act, and we're tending as completely as we can, and it's to the benefit of all beings when we can let it go, let each act go, let each interaction go, and be there for the next one. I think it's good. I've had this lifetime, and my lifetime continues on because I need a lot of time to work with it. I really do. So, anyone have anything they'd like to share? Yeah.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I was struck by your saying, why would anybody want to hold on to a discouraging or some kind of a bad thought. And, I find myself doing that a lot. And when you said that made me really think about, well, why do I? And I think that the reason is that the opposite, a pleasant thought, is something that is resolved in your life. And there really isn't any sort of reason to keep thinking about it because it's already satisfactorily filed away, whereas opposed to a disturbing thought or something like that, it's something that you find yourself mulling over all the time. There's always possibly this answer or possibly that answer or something like that where it just churns around all the time, and my mind isn't capable of just being quiet, and so I end up with a lot of those thoughts, and I think that's one of the reasons why I would hold on to an unpleasant thought.
Maybe that's one of the reasons you do. Let me see, something passed through my mind with that. It's I know, it's that thing of, I know when I'm reviewing things, going over them, I don't know that there's ever, what we're doing then is looking at something that happened, looking at it, reinventing it, recreating it, thinking what should have, could have, would have. And I don't know that it ever brings me any insight that really helps in the next time. if I thought my, there's a word for it, reflection, was going to bring insight and bring, therefore, a change and an awakening. These are big words, let's just say. Bring perhaps a more beneficial result for one person or another. That's one thing that my experience is that it doesn't. I think it's habit. And what I was experiencing as I was considering this is that it fills the space. It really fills the space. And I don't necessarily know, as I said, what it would feel like to not fill that space. That's a risk. We're encouraged. We're encouraged in this practice to do it. And it's a risk. And I think we have to support ourselves as we get, are given the opportunities to get closer to letting go, letting this drop. What brought this up for me too was that I am meeting people every day who are living with cancer diagnosis or very, life-threatening diagnosis. And they're being asked, to let this drop in some way. I can, my understanding is if they can just be, if they can settle, this is the place of being settled. There's not another place. And if I have that understanding and I carry that with me just in being intending, not in verbalizing, for this other person, what am I doing for myself? I'm to let drop something that's challenging for me in the moment is as challenging as letting drop the possibility that this illness will take me to my death. How to say this? Achan Cha has a kind of a little saying. It's to let go a little brings a little peace. To let go a lot can bring a lot of peace. To let go completely will bring complete peace, because your challenges with this world will have come to an end. So the practice of letting go a little when the challenges are little, letting go moderately, or say a lot, when the challenges seem more challenging, and to be able to then let go completely, I would hope would then be accessible to us when we need to let go completely.
Well, I was wondering about what your process is with doing this. When something comes up, do you have a red flag that says, like, oh, there's something more than attendance that I'm feeling here, I'm feeling unsettled, or how is it that you, what brings you to reflect and say, okay, I'm going to let this go deliberately?
What brought it in that weekend experience was some sense of anxiety, some sense of concern, some sense of focusing on the task as opposed to the event. It's a feeling. So say, let go of feelings. Let go of perceptions. Yeah, that might be it. There's also something for my own self, in realizing my temperament, is that I have a very active judge. There's kind of a judging mind that's always kind of judging what's adequate or not adequate. So that's too something that needs to be set aside or diminished. So knowing our proclivities, or our habits, our temperaments, all those things are helpful. Yeah.
I'm having some difficulty with the idea of not reflecting.
Mm-hmm.
And no doubt a lot of it may be unproductive, but because I do a lot of that, I mean, a lot of it is, how could I have handled this situation better, or this person better, or, I mean, I think there is an amount of learning that happens with that. So myself, I would have difficulty letting go of it completely, but maybe I could let go of the unproductive part.
Yes. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I think that's what I'm talking to. Yeah.
And too, I think some of it, you know, is just, I think a lot of that reflection on the inner process, or a lot of times the past, when a person is in therapy can be, you know, tremendously advantageous to their growth. But I mean, I certainly agree with you that or at least for myself, when I try to be completely present, or when I want to be but I'm not, then I think there's a problem there that I need to, or challenge that I need to look at.
I want to say something now. I want to say something to respond to you. Just real quick, the thought that came up when you said that, I wonder if I could hold myself completely.